and you seem upset. This must be hard for him, all of this, Bridget says delicately. The accident? The police? As Karen stares back at her, she amends, for both of you. Karen shifts her eyes away, toward the window. After a short silence, Bridget asks, have you remembered anything helpful to the police? No, Karen says, rather sharply. How have things been with you? She asks, trying to change the subject. Karen, this is Bridget you're talking to. You can tell me anything. She means it. It annoys her that Karen's so tight-lipped. She doesn't disclose many of the intimate details of her life. Bridget has told Karen about her difficulties getting pregnant, her failed fertility treatments. But Karen never shares. Even now, when things are far from perfect, and you'd think she'd need a friend. How shocking it must be for Karen, she thinks suddenly, that things aren't absolutely perfect. Things should be more equal between friends, Bridget believes. And as far as she's concerned, Karen hasn't done as good a job at their friendship as she could have. Bridget has worked very hard at this friendship. Karen has no idea how hard it's been, how much she's had to swallow. Karen doesn't know about her and Tom, how difficult it's been for her all this time watching Karen and Tom together, having to pretend it doesn't bother her. So many times she's been tempted to blurt it out, but she's always bitten her tongue. Karen's never taken that great an interest in Bridget's life, really, Bridget thinks now. Not as great an interest as Bridget has taken in hers. For instance, Karen has never shown much curiosity about her knitting blog, something that has always bugged her. Bridget Cruikshank is a goddess among online knitters, but Karen doesn't knit, and she doesn't care. Karen looks at her now and says, I appreciate your concern, Bridget. I really do. You're a good friend. She smiles at Bridget. Bridget smiles back mechanically. You know, my headache's getting worse. I should probably lie down, Karen says. She gets up off the sofa and walks Bridget to the door. I hope you feel better, Bridget says, and gives Karen a brief hug. Then she walks back across the street to her own empty house and takes up her position at the window with her knitting to wait for Tom to come home. It's grown late in the afternoon, and it seems clear that Karen Krupp isn't going to show up voluntarily. Rasbach is pondering next steps when Jennings enters his office and says, "We might have something." Rasbach lifts his eyes. "I just got a call from a pawnbroker I spoke to after we found the body. He says a boy just pawned a watch and a ring." "Does he know the boy?" "Yep." "Let's go," Rasbach says, grabbing his shoulder harness and his jacket. When they arrive at Gus's pawn shop, the place is empty except for the owner standing behind a grimy counter. The man nods at Jennings, recognizing him, and chews the inside of his cheek. "This is Gus," Jennings says, introducing him to Rasbach. The man nods. "Want to show us what you've got?" Jennings asks. The man dips below the counter and brings out a man's watch and lays it on the glass counter. Beside it, he places a heavy gold ring. The detectives take a look. "Looks expensive," Rasbach says.
"Yep, genuine Rolex."
Rasbach pulls on a pair of latex gloves and examines first the watch and then the ring for any identifying marks or engraving, but there's nothing. He puts the items back down on the counter, disappointed.
"How did the boy say he came by these?" Rasbach asks. "He said he found them."
"What's his name?" Rasbach asks.
"Here's the thing," Gus says. "I know the kid. He's only 14 years old. I don't want him to get into a lot of trouble."
"I understand," Rasbach says. "But we need to know if he found anything else. Any ID along with the jewelry. Something that will help us with our investigation. We don't think this boy had anything to do with the murder."
"I just want you to scare him," Gus says. Like, scare him straight, you know? Too many kids get into crime around here. I don't want to see him go down that road.
Sure, I get that, Rasbach says, nodding. What's his name?
Duncan Mackey. Lives over on Fenton, number 153. I know the family. Go easy on him, but not too easy.
Rasbach and Jennings drive to the address Gus gave them. Rasbach's hoping that this is the lead they've been waiting for. He knocks on the front door of the shabby house. He's relieved when a woman answers, because he can't talk to the boy without a responsible adult present. Rasbach says, "Are you Duncan Mackey's mother?" The woman immediately looks alarmed. When he shows his badge, she looks worse.
"What's he done?"
the woman asks, dismayed.
"We just want to talk to him," Rasbach says. "Is he home?"
She steps back from the door and lets the detectives in.
"Duncan!"
she hollers up the stairs. Rasbach and Jennings sit in the tiny kitchen and wait. The boy comes down the stairs, sees the detectives sitting in his kitchen, and stops dead. He looks at his mom nervously.
"Sit down, Duncan,"
the woman says sternly. The boy sits and stares at the table. His face is flushed and sullen. Rasbach says,
"Duncan, we're police detectives. You don't have to talk to us. You can ask us to leave if you want. You're not in custody."
The boy says nothing, but looks up at him cautiously. Rasbach says,
"We're interested in the watch and the ring that you left with Gus."
The boy squirms and says nothing, while his mother glares at him.
"We just want to know if he found a wallet, too. Something with identification in it."
"Fucking Gus," the boy mutters.
"Duncan," his mother says harshly. Rasbach says,
"If you have the wallet, maybe we can let this go."
It seems to dawn on the mother then why they're here.
"This isn't about that dead man that was found near here, is it?"
Her face is stricken. The boy looks nervously at his mother, and then at the detectives.
"He was already dead when we got there. I can get the wallet."
His mother covers her mouth with her hand.
"I think that would be a good idea," Rasbach says, "because this is making your mother very upset, Duncan. And I think it would be better to come clean and turn over a new leaf before it's too late. You don't want to be arrested, do you?"
The boy shakes his head.
"I'll get it."
He looks at his mother.
"You stay here."
Then he bolts back upstairs, where he obviously has a hiding place he doesn't want his mother to know about. After a strained moment, they hear him pounding down the stairs, and he reappears in the kitchen. He hands a leather wallet over to Rasbach. It still has a few bills in it. Rasbach takes the wallet from him and opens it, pulls out a driver's license.
"Thanks, Duncan."
He gets up. Jennings turns to the boy on their way out and gives him a friendly look.
"Stay in school," he says.
As they walk to the car, Rasbach says with satisfaction,
"We've got him. Robert Traynor of Las Vegas, Nevada."
He feels the familiar adrenaline surge he gets when a case begins to move. They get into the car and head back to the police station. Soon, Rasbach is reviewing some very interesting material. The dead man, Robert J. Traynor, was 39 years old, a successful dealer in antiques. No children. His wife, Georgina Traynor, had predeceased him about 3 years earlier. Rasbach looks at a photo of Georgina. He leans forward, examines it more closely, imagines her with shorter, darker hair. He looks again at the dates.
Bingo.
Georgina Traynor isn't dead. She's alive and well, and living at 24 Dogwood Drive. Chapter 31. Karen climbs upstairs and lies down on the bed, relieved to be alone. Bridget had made her feel uncomfortable. Maybe a nap before Tom gets home will help get rid of her pounding headache. She's rigid on top of the covers, staring at the ceiling. She's going to be charged with murder. Everything would still be perfect, she thinks bitterly, tears leaking down the sides of her face, if it weren't for Robert finding her. She wonders how he did it, 3 years later. How was he able to track her down? Finally, she crawls under the covers and falls into a brief, exhausted sleep. Razbok sits at his desk and rubs his tired eyes. He picks up the picture of Georgina Traynor again and thinks about Karen Krupp in her comfortable suburban home. She's probably frightened out of her wits, he thinks. His next thought, she's been frightened before and found a way out. She's a survivor. He looks at the facts, the way he's been trained to do. Married woman fakes death, turns up somewhere else with a new identity. 3 years later, the husband she left behind turns up dead, and it looks like she was there. He knows what it looks like, but he mustn't jump to conclusions. If she was a battered wife, trying to escape an unbearable situation, then truth be told, he's sympathetic to her. He's sympathetic to any woman who's ever been driven to take such extreme measures to protect herself. These things shouldn't happen. But he knows they do, every day. The system does a rather poor job of protecting these women, and he knows it. It's a damaged, messed up world. He's feeling very negative tonight. It's not like him. He wants to solve the case. He always wants to solve the case. He thinks he knows what happened here, and he thinks he knows why. But then it will go out of his hands into the hands of the lawyers, and there's no predicting what will happen. The whole thing depresses him. He thinks about Tom Krupp. He tries to imagine what he must be going through, but he can't quite. Razbok has never been married. The right woman has eluded him all these years. Perhaps it's because of the job. Maybe he will still meet her someday. And when he does, he tells himself, taking another look at the photo of Georgina Traynor, he'll do a thorough background check on her himself. Tom has come home again, and they've had a quiet dinner together, with only the scrape of cutlery on plates to break the silence. Now Karen stares out the living room window into the darkness, unwilling to go to bed. She'll only stare at the ceiling again. She tells herself that there's no one out there. Robert is dead. There's no one to be afraid of now. Except for that detective. And she's terrified of him. Tom's upstairs in his office, working late. She doesn't know how he can work at a time like this. Perhaps it's his way of avoiding thinking about things. He'd rather stare at lines of numbers than into his own appalling future. She doesn't blame him. Her own thoughts are driving her crazy. Razbok is going to be back. She's sure of it. She's wound up tight, as if poised for flight. But she's made Tom a promise. She has to place her faith in Jack Calvin. She decides to go upstairs and have a long, hot bath. Maybe it will help her relax. She puts her head in the upstairs office and tells Tom. He looks up briefly, nods, and looks back at his computer screen. She turns away and goes into the bathroom and starts filling the tub, trying to decide between bubble bath and Epsom salts. But what does it matter? Razbok is still going to arrest her. As her eyes fall briefly on the vanity, she freezes. Something's wrong. Her pulse begins to race. Her heart knocks painfully against her ribs and she feels slightly dizzy. She scans the vanity quickly, trying to take in details. It's her perfume. Someone has taken the stopper off her perfume. She knows it wasn't her. Karen stares at the perfume bottle, paralyzed with fear, as if she's found a snake curled on the vanity. She didn't use that perfume today. She's certain of it. And she would never leave the stopper off.
Tom!
She calls his name frantically, but he doesn't seem to hear her over the rushing water of the taps. She runs down the hall to his office, screaming his name. She collides with him in the office doorway. What is it? Tom asks her, his eyes wild. Before she can find the words to tell him, he rushes past her into the bathroom. She comes up behind him.
What? What is it?
He asks. He can't see what's scaring her so badly, but he's infected by her panic. Karen points at the perfume bottle, with the stopper lying on the vanity behind it.
My perfume! Someone took the stopper off! It wasn't me!
Tom looks at the perfume bottle, then back at her, relieved, but irritated.
Is that all? Are you sure? Maybe you just left it off and forgot.
No, Tom, I didn't,
she says sharply. She can tell that he doesn't believe her.
Karen, he says, you're under a lot of stress. Maybe you're just forgetting things. You know what the doctor said. I can hardly keep things straight these days myself. Yesterday I left my car keys in the office and had to go all the way back up to get them.
That's you, she says, not me.
She looks at him, and she can feel a hardness coming into her eyes.
I can't afford not to notice details like this, she says, her voice taking on a tone of underlying rage. Because for years, if I didn't do something just right, if things weren't just so, I'd get the living shit beat out of me. So I noticed the little things, and I did not leave the stopper off that perfume bottle. Someone has been in this house.
Okay, calm down, Tom says.
Don't tell me to calm down,
she screams at him. They stand in the small bathroom, facing one another. She can see that he's as shocked as she is at her reaction. Her raw emotion has unsettled and appalled them both. They've never been this way with each other before. Then she notices the bathtub and hurries over to turn off the taps before the tub overflows. She straightens up and looks at him. She's calmer now, but still frightened.
I'm sorry, Tom. I don't mean to yell at you, but someone must have been in here.
Karen,
Tom says. He's using a soothing tone, as if he's speaking to a child.
Your former husband is dead. Who else would break into our house? Any ideas?
When she says nothing, Tom asks, rather delicately,
Do you want me to call the police?
She can't tell for sure if he's being sarcastic.
Do you want me to call the police about an opened perfume bottle?
Or whether he's just exhausted and overwhelmed with everything that's happened. But there's something in his tone.
No, don't call the police, she says.
When he stands there, saying nothing further, she says, Go. I'm going to have a bath. He leaves, and she locks the bathroom door behind him. Chapter 32 Bridget sits and watches out the window. She never tires of it. Every now and then, she sniffs delicately at her wrist. She will stay up until Tom and Karen go to bed, until they are safely tucked in and all their lights are out. Her husband, Bob, has been home briefly for dinner, but he's gone out again tonight for another function. That's every night this week. She wonders if it's really all work, or whether he's seeing someone on the side. She finds she doesn't really care. Still, she's simmering with rage beneath her cool, white skin. The cool, white skin that he hasn't touched in weeks, and they're supposed to be trying to have a baby. Sometimes she hates Bob. Sometimes she hates her life and everybody in it. Except there aren't that many people in her life anymore. She's let a lot of things drop. Except for her knitting blog and the crops. Mostly, Bridget keeps an eye on Karen and Tom. She would like to be someone else, in some other life.
That's what she'd really like. She's slightly surprised to realize that what she wants most in the world isn't, after all, to be pregnant at last with Bob's baby. She's wanted that for so long that the wishing for it, the fantasizing about it, has become automatic. How refreshing to realize that she actually, earnestly, wants something else for a change. That she would actually like to be someone else, in another life entirely. Someone with a handsome, caring husband. A husband who pays attention. Who comes home every night. Someone who would make her feel special, and take her to Europe, and kiss her at odd moments for no reason, and look at her the way Tom looks at Karen. She puts her knitting down. She hasn't been able to resist the pull of the Krupp's house. She can't help sneaking into their house across the street sometimes, and being there, alone, imagining herself living there with Tom, lying in their bed, going through Karen's things, going through Tom's things, holding Tom's clothes to her face and smelling them. She even took an old t-shirt of Tom's from his drawer and hid it at home. Trying on Karen's clothes in front of her mirror, using her lipstick, her perfume, pretending that she's Tom's wife. It's easy to do. She has a key. Tom had given her one during their brief affair, and she'd secretly made a copy before she returned it. She can take the path alongside the Krupp's house that leads to the park beyond, and as long as there's no one looking, she can sneak in the unlocked gate and go in through the back door, with no one to see her do it. She'd left the glass on the counter that day. She's really never stopped wanting Tom. It's just a question of what she's willing to do to get him back. This hits her rather hard, and she holds her breath for a second. Lately, she hasn't been able to stop thinking about what they were like together, back when they were lovers. They had some serious chemistry. And Tom was such a pleasure to seduce, so eager to try new things, so willing to follow her lead. How perfect it all was, before he broke it off with her, and started seeing Karen instead. He hadn't been comfortable with the fact that she was married, but he'd swallowed her flirtatious little lie and been happy to sleep with her anyway. That changed when he learned the truth. He dumped her. God, how it hurt. She'd made things difficult for him for a while. She couldn't help it. She felt so out of control. Bob had no idea what was going on, but he could see how upset and unhappy she was. He insisted she see someone. Eventually, she adjusted. She'd even been able to agree with Tom. Quite civilly, she'd thought. Not to tell anyone about their affair. They've kept it secret from Karen all this time. Oh, all the times Bridget had wanted to tell her, over coffee, about what she and Tom had done together. Now, Bridget recalls the electricity that went through her body the other night when she touched Tom's arm. She's sure he felt it too, that intense sexual energy that they'd shared flaring up again. Surely that's why he stepped away from her so quickly. He can't admit that he still has feelings for her. He's married now. He's too decent a man for that. But she's sure those feelings he had for her are still there. She wonders if he's getting tired of Karen by now. She's picked up on the tension between them. Bridget knows that Karen thinks of her as her best friend, even though Karen doesn't know how to be a very good friend sometimes. Karen has disappointed her again and again. It's hard to think of Karen the same way now, after everything that's happened. After all she's put Tom through. Especially since Bridget's realized that she might be able to get Tom for herself.
Karen's not her friend. She's her rival. She's always been her rival. A whole world seems to be opening up before Bridget. A new future unfurling. Bridget has sat in this spot by the window these last few days, avidly following the goings-on across the street. She knows Karen's in deep trouble. Maybe soon, the police will arrest her for murder. And then, Tom will be all alone, and understandably shattered. He'll be doubting Karen and everything they had together. And Bridget will be there, helping him pick up the pieces, nudging him in the right direction, away from Karen, toward her. There will be more of that electricity between them. She's sure of it. And he won't be able to resist coming back to her. They were meant to be together. Everything happens for a reason. She'll leave Bob. He'll probably barely notice. And she'll move in across the street. She'll have everything she's ever wanted. Karen's beautifully decorated home, her smart clothes. As luck would have it, they're the same size. Her handsome, attentive husband. She suspects Tom has a good sperm count, too, unlike her useless husband, Bob. Bridget's heart flutters at the prospect of her future as she watches the lights across the street. That night, Tom lies awake, unable to sleep. Karen is moving around fitfully in the bed. It wasn't until that overwrought moment in the bathroom, with Karen screaming at him, that he really began to understand what she must have been through and what it must have done to her. For the first time, he realized that there are whole parts of her that he's never had any access to. Dark, angry parts of her, and a grim history that she'll never share fully with him. He now knows the broad outlines of how she'd lived, but he doesn't know all the ugly details. This sudden glimpse into her, into the darkness at the heart of her past, has shaken him badly. She really isn't the woman he thought she was. She's much tougher, much harder, and much more damaged than he ever suspected. She's not the woman he fell in love with. The woman he fell in love with, Karen Fairfield, was a mirage. He never knew Georgina Traynor. If he had, would he have fallen in love with her? Would he have been man enough to fall in love with a woman with her kind of baggage? Or would he have stayed the hell away? He likes to think he would have fallen in love with her just the same, and taken her safely away from all that. But the lies. He's not sure he can get past the lies. Yes, Karen had her excellent reasons for what she did, but she lied to him. Her wedding vows were a lie, and he's sure she would have kept lying to him if the police hadn't tripped her up. That's what's bothering him. The question he keeps asking himself is, if she hadn't had the accident that night, if she'd managed to calm herself down and come home, would she have made up some story about a friend calling her with an emergency, a story he wouldn't have questioned? Would she have gone to bed with him that night and lain beside him, knowing that she'd shot a man dead, with him never being any the wiser? Because Tom doesn't believe that she wasn't capable of killing her former husband. He's sure now, after that outburst in the bathroom, that she is capable of it. If things had gone just a little differently, he might have continued in his happy, ignorant bubble, unaware of her crime. But he can't ignore it now. And the one other thing he can't forget. The gloves. She took the gloves with her. Tom is certain that she intended to kill her former husband. Or why take the gloves?
There's no doubt in his mind about that. As far as the law is concerned, he's pretty sure she's guilty. Whether he can live with that or not, the jury's still out. Chapter 33. The next day, just before noon, Karen's alone in the house when she hears a firm knock at the front door. When she peeks out and sees the detectives, she knows the time has come. She has only a moment to pull herself together before she opens the door. Rasbach stands on the front porch, looking more serious than she has yet seen him. That's how she knows. They've figured out who the dead man is. "May we come in?" he asks, his tone surprisingly gentle. She pulls open the door. She wants it to be over. She cannot bear the tension any longer. "Is your husband home?" Rasbach asks. She shakes her head. "Do you want to call him? We can wait."
"No, that won't be necessary."
She feels calm, detached, as if none of this is really happening. It's like a dream, or as if it's happening to someone else. She's lost her opportunity to flee. It's too late now. Rasbach says,
"Karen Krupp, you are under arrest for the murder of Robert Traynor. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to an attorney."
She holds her hands out in front of her as Jennings puts the handcuffs on her. Her legs suddenly go weak. She tells herself she will not faint. Hears, as if from a distance, "Catch her." She feels strong arms at her back. And then nothing. Tom bolts out of the office and races to the police station. Jack Calvin has called him and told him that Karen is already there, under arrest. Calvin, too, is on his way. Tom's knuckles are white from squeezing the steering wheel, and he's clenching his jaw hard. His world is coming completely apart. He doesn't know what to do, how to act. He hopes Jack Calvin will be able to advise him. He was expecting this, but it's still a shock. You don't exchange wedding vows expecting one day to hear that your wife is at the police station under arrest for murder. He stops at a red light. He doesn't understand, Karen. He doesn't understand why she did it. There were other options. She could have told him. They could have gone to the police. Why didn't she go to the police? She didn't have to go there that night and kill that son of a bitch. The light changes, and he pulls ahead impatiently with a jerk. He's angry at her. For lying to him. For bringing this madness down upon them unnecessarily. She's going to go to prison. He'll have to visit her there. He feels for a moment like he might throw up. He pulls over into a store's parking lot to wait for the feeling to pass. Now he's grateful that they hadn't yet had children. Thank God, he thinks bitterly, for that. Karen is sitting in an interview room with her lawyer on her right side, waiting for the detectives to arrive. Before they were brought in here, Calvin told her what to expect.
"You have the right to remain silent, and you're going to use it," Calvin said bluntly. "We're going to listen to their questions, get a feel for what they know or suspect. You're not going to say anything. That will come later when you're ready to make a statement."
She nodded nervously. "Okay."
"The state must prove its case against you. Your job is not to help them do that. Your job is to follow my instructions. If you listen to me and do what I say, it all may work out."
And then he added, "Although I can't promise anything, of course." She swallowed, her throat dry. "They must have enough, or they wouldn't have charged me," Karen said, her voice tense.
"There's a higher standard of proof at trial," Calvin told her.
"Courage.
Let's take it one step at a time."
And then she was brought in here. Her handcuffs have already been removed.
perhaps because she's a woman, she thinks, or perhaps because of the nature of her alleged crime. She's probably not considered dangerous. They think she's a woman who killed her husband in cold blood, but surely they don't think she's likely to kill anyone else. At the sound of the door opening, Karen starts nervously. Rasbach and Jennings enter.
"Can I get you anything?" Rasbach asks her politely. "Water? Coffee?"
She shakes her head no. After the necessary preliminaries, the videotaped interview begins. Rasbach says, "We know that Karen Krupp is a new identity for you, one that you adopted about 3 years ago." He's sitting directly across from her, a buff folder closed on the table in front of him. The detective looks down at the file and opens it. Karen immediately sees the photograph there of her as Georgina. She recognizes the picture. She knows he wants her to see it. She merely glances at it and raises her eyes again. He reviews the file silently for a moment, then looks up at her. "We know that you are actually Georgina Traynor, and that you were married to Robert Traynor, the man shot to death last week. And we can put you at the scene of the murder." She says nothing. Beside her, Calvin sits quietly. He seems to be completely relaxed, but alert, not unlike the detective who sits diagonally across from him. She's grateful that she has Calvin here. If she were alone in this room with Rasbach, she might make a mistake. But Calvin is here to make sure that doesn't happen.
"I tell you what," Rasbach says. "I'll tell you what I think, and you can just nod if I'm on the right track."
"She's not an imbecile," Calvin says mildly.
"I'm well aware of that," Rasbach answers curtly. "Anyone who can successfully fake her own death is clearly not an imbecile."
He turns his gaze to Karen. "Maybe we should talk about that first."
"My hat's off to you. You're obviously a very clever woman."
He's trying to get her to talk by appealing to her ego, she thinks. It's not going to work. She'll talk when it suits her, when she's ready. She knows she's going to jail, because Calvin has told her that there's no bail on a charge of murder. The thought of jail petrifies her.
"Tell me how you did it," Rasbach says.
She says nothing.
"Okay, then tell me why you did it. Why did you fake such an elaborate, convincing death and start over as someone else?"
When she still doesn't speak, he says,
"My guess is that you were running from your husband. My guess is that you were a battered wife and you had to get away. He wouldn't let you leave. You couldn't just divorce him. He would come after you. So you faked your death. But then, after 3 years, he calls you up on the phone. You're in your kitchen, in your new life. You hear his voice. You're shocked, terrified. You panic."
She lets him talk. She wants to hear what he has to say, what he thinks he knows.
"He asks you to meet him," Rasbach continues. "Perhaps he threatens you that if you don't, he will come after you and kill you. He knows your phone number. He no doubt knows where you live. So you agree to see him. You fly out of the house that night. You're so rattled that you don't think to leave a note for your husband. You don't bring your phone or your purse. You don't even lock the door."
Rasbach sits back in his chair. She's watching him. Their eyes are locked. He waits a long moment.
"Or maybe you were thinking more clearly than we've all been giving you credit for."
He pauses for effect.
"Maybe there's a reason you don't bring your phone or your purse. You don't want to risk leaving anything behind. Maybe you didn't bring your phone because you were afraid it could be used to locate you. Maybe you were thinking pretty clearly after all. Because you brought a gun. A .38 caliber handgun, which we're still looking for, by the way. And you brought your rubber gloves with you."
He adds, "All of which looks like premeditation to me." Rasbach leans forward and looks deeply into her eyes, his blue eyes piercing hers. She's frightened by his gaze, but is determined not to show it. Razbok's ignoring her lawyer and the other detective, as if it's only the two of them in the room. She has to remind herself that she's not alone with this detective. But his eyes are mesmerizing. Calvin breaks in.
You're dreaming about the gun, and you have no idea whose gloves those are. You can't prove they belong to my client.
I think I can, Razbok counters.
He doesn't take his eyes off Karen to look, even briefly, at her lawyer.
I think you took a gun, and those gloves, and drove down to that abandoned restaurant on Hoffman Street, and parked in the little parking lot nearby. You went into the deserted restaurant where Robert Traynor was waiting for you, and you shot him in cold blood.
Karen remains stubbornly silent, and reminds herself that they don't have the weapon that killed him, and even if they find it, it can't possibly hurt her. She's confident about the gun. They can't prove that she had a gun when she went into that restaurant. They can only prove that she was there.
What did you do with a gun? Razbok asks.
She feels a sudden stab of fear and quickly smothers it. He doesn't know about the gun, she thinks. He might guess or assume, but that's all.
It's more than possible, Razbok continues, even likely that you owned a gun illegally. A woman as smart as you, a woman who faked her death, fooling all and sundry, a woman who began over with a new identity and didn't get caught until her husband found her. How do you think he found you, by the way?
Her thighs tense under the table, but she will not be drawn into conversation with him. Razbok tilts his head at her.
And then, after you shot him, then you panicked. You saw that you'd killed him. Did you drop the gun? Because you panicked? Or because you knew it couldn't be traced to you and didn't have your prints on it and it didn't matter? Or did you take it with you and toss it out the window somewhere?
The detective pushes himself away from the table, and the sudden movement startles her and she flinches in her seat. He gets up and starts walking around the room, as if he's thinking it through as he speaks. But she's not fooled. This is all an act. He's an actor, just as she is. They are each other's audience. He's planned everything he's going to say.
When you get to your car, you tear off the gloves and drop them there in the parking lot. This is why I know you are panicking at this point, because why leave the gloves behind? There could be traces of your skin, your DNA on the inside of the gloves.
He turns and looks at her intently. She looks away. She can feel herself begin to tremble and tenses her body hard to stop it. She does not want him to see how frightened she is.
And we both know how important those gloves are, don't we, Georgina?
He stops in front of her and looks down at her. She refuses to lift her head to look at him.
Because if we get DNA off those gloves, they prove without a doubt that you were there. And because those gloves show intention.
He pulls his chair out and sits down again, and waits until she raises her eyes to him.
By then, you were so panicked by what you'd done that you got in your car and drove as fast as you could to get away from there. Everyone agrees that you never go over the speed limit. Everybody goes over the speed limit sometimes, but not you. You never go through a red light. Why? Because you never want to get pulled over by the police. Because the number one rule for people who have taken on new identities is keep a low profile. And that's what you did. For years. Everyone we spoke to was shocked at the way you drove that night. It was so out of character. You know what? I'm wondering what your character is really like when you're not pretending to be someone else.
He's getting to her. She feels angry and threatened, but she must remain in control. She wonders why her lawyer doesn't say something. She knows she can't deny who she is, They can easily prove that she's Georgina Traynor. They know she faked her death and ran away and took on a false identity. These are things she will admit to. She might have to admit that she was there. But they cannot prove that she killed him. They have no weapon, no witness. They have motive, though. And that's what scares her. She had plenty of motive to kill her husband, and they all know it.
So let's just say you panicked, Rasbach continues. You got in the car, drove too fast, lost control, and hit a pole. Rather unfortunate. Because if you hadn't panicked, you would probably have gotten away with murder.
She looks up at him now. She hates him at this moment.
If you'd calmly driven home, put the gloves back in your kitchen, made up some story for your husband about where you'd been, then no one would ever have connected you to the dead body in that abandoned restaurant. We would eventually have figured out who he was, and we would have seen that his wife had predeceased him years earlier, but that's it. That would have been the end of it, as far as you're concerned. There wouldn't have been any red flags. No car accident, no tire tracks, no gloves, to connect you to the crime. No one to look at you and find out that you're not who you say you are. You would have gone on with your nice suburban life with your new, unsuspecting husband.
She wants to slap his smug, superior face. Instead, she drives her fingernails into her palms under the table, where he can't see.
But the thing is, I can understand why you did what you did. I really can. You don't want to tell me what life with Robert Traynor was like, but I think it will come out at trial. If the state proves that you killed him, of course you will want everyone to know why you killed him. You will want to paint as monstrous a picture of the man as you possibly can. More power to you. He probably was a monster. To drive a nice woman like you to murder.
She looks straight ahead at the wall in front of her, digging her fingernails into her palms.
I think that's all, for now, Rasbach says.
The interview is over. Chapter 34. Bridget knows what's happened. She saw the two detectives arrive around lunchtime. She'd been waiting, hoping for such a development. She watched them bring Karen out of the house in handcuffs. She could hardly contain her satisfaction. She has been keeping a restless eye on the house all day, waiting for Tom to come home so that she can comfort him. He'll be alone now in that house, his life all but destroyed. Bridget knows it's all over for Karen. She will be convicted. She's sure of it. And then Tom can begin again, with her. They'll be happy together, happier than he ever was with Karen. And she will never tear his life apart the way Karen has. Someday, Tom will see that Karen being taken away in handcuffs was the best thing that ever happened to him. Tom returns home in a state of shock. His wife has been arrested for murder, and he's pretty sure she did it. He wanders aimlessly into the kitchen and opens the fridge. He stands there, staring inside, suddenly remembering that other time he stood here, staring sightlessly into the refrigerator. The night Karen disappeared. The night this all began. This is going to destroy their marriage. It's going to destroy their lives. And now his wife is caught up in the workings of the legal system. This is going to bankrupt him. He reaches in for a beer. He screws the cap off almost violently and then turns and hurls it across the room. The cap hits a cupboard and ricochets around the kitchen, ending up somewhere under the table. What the fuck is he going to do? He paces the house angrily. There's nothing he can do. He can't believe it's come to this. And he's sure it's going to get worse in the days, weeks, and months ahead. He doesn't bother making himself something to eat. He has no appetite for food. He finishes the first beer quickly and returns automatically to the fridge for another. He's never been tested like this before. And he doesn't like what he sees. He's weak, and he's a coward, and he knows it. He's been trying to be strong for Karen, but his wife is much stronger and braver than he is. She appears to be made of steel. He stares in the mirror over the fireplace. He hardly recognizes himself. His hair is wild from nervously running his hands through it. He looks haggard, almost mean. He expected everything to be sunshine and kisses when he married Karen. It's as if life made him a promise the day that he married her, and now life has broken that promise. He feels intensely sorry for himself. He steps out the sliding glass doors to the backyard and sits outside on the patio in the summer night as darkness falls upon him. Funny, he thinks now, 3 beers in. It hasn't occurred to him until this moment to remember what a hard time he had getting her to say yes. Of course, it all makes sense now. She was already married. The first time he asked her to marry him, she laughed it off, as if he couldn't possibly mean it. Although he was careful not to show it, he'd been both taken aback and hurt. He wondered why she treated his proposal so flippantly. He was completely serious when he asked her. They were lying all bundled up on a scratchy wool blanket, looking at the stars. They'd gone to a little inn in the Catskills for the weekend to see the fall colors. He grabbed the blanket from the back of the car and found a private spot. They lay down together, and he propped himself up on one elbow and gazed down at her. He can still remember the way the moonlight lit her face, and the happiness in her eyes. He asked, "Will you marry me?" And she laughed, as if he were making a joke. He looks up at those same stars now, twinkling in the dark. How changed everything is. He remembers how he hid his hurt and disappointment, both at the time and in the weeks following. He waited a bit, and then bought a big, expensive diamond ring. He wanted to show her that he was serious. He presented it to her on Valentine's Day over a glass of pricey champagne at her favorite restaurant. Perhaps that was a mistake, Valentine's Day. But it doesn't make any difference now. What she said, he recalls, as he sits in the dark on the patio with his beer in his hand, was, "Why can't we have a love story instead of a marriage?" This is their love story come crashing down around their ears. Does he wish now that she'd never said yes? That she'd never agreed, finally, under his steady pressure to get married? He doesn't know. And anyway, it's too late to change anything. And yet, these last 2 years have been the happiest of his life. Until all this happened. Tom sees something moving in the dark, at the side of the house. He freezes. He hasn't turned the light on in the back, not wanting to attract bugs to the light, so it's completely dark except for the stars. He can see someone approaching, but he can't tell who it is. It can't be the police. They've already arrested his wife. Surely they're not going to arrest him, too. He thinks it might be Dan, come to check on him. Dan had called earlier, but Tom hadn't called him back, and he must be worried. All this runs like quicksilver through Tom's head as he gets to his feet. He puts the almost empty bottle of beer down on a side table and squints into the dark. It's not Dan coming toward him in the dark. He sees with dismay. It's Bridget. He doesn't want to talk to Bridget. He wants to go back inside the house and close the door, but he can't exactly do that.
Brigid always makes him feel uncomfortable. He'd been so intimate with her, so unrestrained. There was something reckless and exciting about her that he found irresistible at first, and that touched something reckless in him. But she soon became too intense for him, too much. He felt that she might swallow him whole. He never knew what to expect from her. She was too emotional. When he broke it off with her, he'd had quite a few anxious weeks, afraid that she would tell her husband about them, and he would throw her out, and that she'd come banging on his door. Or later, that she would tell Karen, embellishing what happened with lies, and destroy their promising new relationship. But she seemed to calm down. And then, quite unexpectedly, she'd become such good friends with his wife. There was nothing he could do about that. "Hi, Brigid," he says. He says it crisply, enunciating carefully. He's not drunk, after 3 fast beers on an empty stomach. He's what might be called happy. Except that he's not happy at all. Tom realizes rather suddenly that he doesn't want to be alone. "Would you like a drink?" he asks her. She looks at him as if surprised.
"I knocked at the front, but nobody answered. I came over to talk to Karen," Brigid says. "Is she here?"
"No, I'm afraid not," Tom says, and he can hear the bitterness in his own voice coming across loud and clear.
"What's wrong?" Brigid asks.
He sees her eyes taking in how wrecked he looks, sliding to the beer bottle on the side table. Tom knows that it would be foolish to unburden himself to Brigid, but there's no one else right now. He realizes how terribly lonely he feels without Karen. He's never felt so lonely in his life. He gestures toward the kitchen, just inside.
"Let me get you a drink. What will you have? A beer? Or I can mix you something if you want."
She follows him into the house. He opens the cupboard, scanning the liquor bottles on the shelf to see what he has to offer her. She's standing behind him. When he turns to ask her what she wants, she's staring at him with such avidity that it startles him. He turns back to look inside the cupboard.
"I have rum, vodka..."
"Can you make me a martini?" she asks.
He looks back at her stupidly. When did she get so fancy? He has no idea how to make a martini. He wasn't expecting her to ask for something so exotic.
"I don't know how."
"I do,"
she says smoothly, and comes up beside him and looks into the cupboard. She starts taking down bottles. Vodka, vermouth.
"You must have a shaker around here somewhere," she says, opening another cupboard and looking up high.
Her eyes seem to light immediately on a silver cocktail shaker, something he'd forgotten they even had. Another leftover wedding present. They never use it. He and Karen are unfussy, beer and wine drinkers usually. He remembers how the two of them had needed a shot of whiskey the other night.
"Do you have any ice?" Brigid asks.
Tom turns to the freezer and pulls out the ice. While he's at it, he gets himself another beer. This will be his last one tonight, he promises himself, twisting off the cap and watching Brigid make herself a martini in his kitchen as if she owns the place. It feels strange, having her here instead of Karen.
"So, where's Karen?" she asks.
She's finished with the shaker now. She's grabbed a proper martini glass from the cupboard. He'd forgotten about those, too, and pours herself a drink. She holds the glass close to her lips and takes a sip, looking coyly over the rim at him. For a second, Tom's confused. She's asking about Karen, who's in jail, but her tone is all wrong. She sounds more like she's flirting with him, the way she used to. Suddenly, he regrets having asked her in for a drink. It's too dangerous.
"What's the matter?"
she says, looking more the way she should, and he thinks that maybe he imagined it. He shakes his head.
Nothing, he says.
Then,
everything.